This is Fresh Air. When Ronald Reagan was in the White House, his schedule often set aside 2 or 3 hours a day to staff time, a phrase that some considered a euphemism for nap time. A joke circulating among the press was that Reagan's best-known movie had been reissued under the title Staff Time for Bonzo. This is one of many stories Lou Cannon tells in his new book, President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. It's Cannon's third book about the former president. Lou Cannon covered Ronald Reagan throughout his political career. Cannon covered the California campaigns and Reagan's first term as governor for the San Jose Mercury News. Cannon covered Reagan's years in the White House for the Washington Post. I asked Cannon if he liked Reagan more as a man than as a president.
I like Reagan, of course. Most people who deal with him personally do. He's a decent, unassuming man. I thought he was... My conclusion in my book is that he's a great American, but not a great president, that the role was a little too big for him. I think he did some things well, and I give him great credit for driving a stake through the heart of the Cold War, because when Ronald Reagan brings in a treaty and says Gorbachev's a different kind of Soviet leader, even anti-communist Americans tend to believe him. We've taken a lot of steam out of the great sort of emotional virus that existed in the body politic since the end of World War II, which was this fervent kind of anti-communism that animated the Cold War. I give Reagan a lot of credit for that. I think he didn't understand enough. When you got him off his core agenda, and you had a situation that you couldn't decide by ideology or script, Lebanon being a classic example that Reagan was in over his head. I think he didn't understand, frankly, the difficulty of trying to do something structurally about the deficit, that if you were going to reduce taxes, which he wanted to do and did, and build up the military, which he wanted to do and did, that the only way you were going to balance the budget was, as John Anderson said in 1980, with mirrors. But I think that it wasn't a question so much of him not being qualified for president as he was limited. He was a great performance president. He believed in the performance aspect of the presidency. He thought it hadn't been done very well by Carter and Ford. I think he was right in that. He thought he could do it better, and he was right. He did. But when the cameras weren't rolling and the lights weren't on, he wasn't the decisive leader that he seemed to be in public, and that's where I fault him.
How was he prepped for press conferences where he had to speak extemporaneously, or at least give the appearance of it? I mean, couldn't tell for sure what questions were going to be asked in advance.
Well, he was prepped by these wild rehearsals that they did in the family theater. I think I quote Pat Buchanan in the book saying that contrasting the preparation for of Nixon and of Reagan. Nixon was a very structured guy, and he didn't particularly like people. He knew a lot of things, and they'd go through these intricate written sort of interrogatories. Reagan, who liked people a lot, he'd have people sort of batting questions around. I think that a couple of things about the Reagan press conferences. One is that the course that Reagan followed on his infrequent press conferences was not, it seems to me, written in the stars. Reagan started out, I think he was going to have fairly regular press conferences. After the assassination attempt, and he was seriously wounded, and it was a little more than 2 months into his presidency, he was unable for a long time to do anything except respond in a ceremonial way. And he didn't have a press conference. I can't remember whether it was to June or August, but until that summer, he didn't prepare for it very well. And he answered a lot of questions poorly, and he got rapped for it by people who were usually sympathetic to him. I remember Bill Sapphire wrote a very biting column about Reagan skimping on his preparation. And Reagan, after that, sort of played defense. They held these news conferences as infrequently as possible, And it meant that there was no way that you could get Reagan up for the news conference, because if you were trying to brief him on what happened in 5 months, you couldn't begin to anticipate what would happen. Now, I say he could have been better than he was, because I had the experience with him in Sacramento, where he held nearly weekly news conferences, and he was just dreadful when he started. He was pretty good, though, after a couple of years of doing it, because he was a performance-oriented person. That's the way he'd been raised. That's what his background was as an actor. And if Reagan had done kind of weekly news conferences, I think he would have become good at them. But his staff was too afraid of that, and it fed on itself. And after a while, a news conference for Reagan became simply an ordeal to get through.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Lou Cannon, and while Reagan was in the White House, he covered the White House and Reagan presidency for the Washington Post. His new book about Reagan, which is his third book on Reagan, is called President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Lou Cannon is my guest, author of a new book called President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. We've been reading these new revelations about the arms for hostage deal that was made during the Reagan-Bush campaign, and that, you know, a deal was made, or the theory goes, a deal was made with the Iranians to free the hostages, but to not free them until the election was won and the inauguration was over. Do you think that that's going to prove to be true after further investigation?
I don't, although I've in my columns supported further investigation of it and do. That's a recurrent accusation. I looked at it myself in the this is my third book on Reagan, and a book that I wrote on Reagan a decade ago, my second book on it. I tell you, I don't think it's so for a number of reasons. For one thing, I have a lot of respect for Lloyd Cutler, who was the White House counsel during the Carter years, and he was heavily involved in the negotiations, and he doesn't think it's true. And I think that if Lloyd Cutler felt that it was, I would certainly pay a lot of attention to it. Secondly, Gary Sick, who made these allegations in a New York Times piece that sort of raised this again, said that he hadn't believed it was true for a number of years and now had changed his mind. Well, the fact is that in 1988 he said the same thing in the middle of the campaign. He said, "Now I think it's true." I think that the Carter people have never wanted to think that Reagan won that election fair and square, and so we've sort of got a kind of a conspiracy theory that's come up now. When Bill Casey is dead, anybody who reads my book will know that I think that Bill Casey was capable of doing anything, but I don't think there's been nothing to the substance of this allegation. It's so easy to make an accusation against Kennedy or Nixon or Reagan or Carter, but I think the burden of proof is upon those who make it, and there's been no evidence for it. The other reason, I guess, I think that my gut sort of tells me it isn't true, although I certainly think it ought to be investigated, is that I don't see what was in it for the Iranians. What was supposed to be in it for the Iranians was that the Israelis would start shipping them arms again. Well, the Israelis shipped arms to the Iranians at every chance they got. They stopped for a while when our hostages were, but they started up again right afterwards, and clearly it didn't matter who was in the White House. That was the policy they were following because they thought it was in their own interest. I don't see why that Iran would have wanted Reagan to come to power. In fact, I think the historical evidence suggests that they did not.
How much do you think Reagan knew about the Iran-Contra affair?
You got to separate the two of them. First of all, in the Iran, you don't have any Iran-Contra affair, and if you don't have the sale of arms to Iran, and the responsibility for that is solely at Reagan's doorstep. Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Weinberger didn't agree on very many things. Weinberger cracked afterwards that it shows what happened when we agree. We should never agree. Reagan did that, and he did it, by the way, Terry, to free he really identified with the plight of the people who were held captive, Americans held captive in Lebanon. And whatever you can say about Ronald Reagan is he wouldn't have for one day wanted any one of them to be held one day longer than was necessary. In fact, he felt their plight so deeply that it got in the way of the sensible policy that his administration had proclaimed, which was no arms for hostages, because the reason for that policy was that if you started doing it, you were going to have happen exactly what happened in the Iran-Contra affair. People would release some hostages, but once they became currency, they'd take more. Now, on the Iran part of it, it's more complicated. Reagan could certainly pass a lie detector test on the question of whether or not he's always said he didn't know about that, the diversion, and he believes that he didn't know about the diversion. Bud McFarlane, I quote him in my book, thinks that it's quite likely that Poindexter briefed Reagan, but briefed him kind of on the fly or on the cuff, as McFarlane himself had often done, and that Reagan simply wasn't paying attention, or I think that's possible. There's two aspects to that diversion, though. One is the profiteering that people like Secord, you know, posing as a patriot, did. Reagan was genuinely appalled at that. That's something he certainly didn't know and wouldn't have allowed. But on the other question of sending these arms and stuff to the Contras, people like Oliver North, who was a zealot but not a profiteer, was saying that he was doing what he thought Reagan wanted done. Reagan's instructions to McFarlane had been to keep the Contras together body and soul, and I think that Reagan bears a great responsibility for that, for the Contra part of it as well, because it certainly was reasonable that the people who were supplying the Contras thought they were doing what Reagan wanted done in view of his statements. Of course, he didn't keep track of it, but he didn't keep track of very much that went on in the White House.
I want to ask you a few things about yourself and about your new book. Now, your book came out at the same time as the Kitty Kelly biography of Nancy Reagan came out. How did that affect you, you know, in terms of how the book was reviewed and where it was reviewed, if it was reviewed with her book or not?
Well, it certainly affected my publisher. It's the same publisher. It told me that Kitty Kelly's book was coming out later, and I wish they had been right in what they said to me. And it certainly did affect it in the way you just suggested, in that they were reviewed at the same time. And there's a lot of bookstores in this country where they've got sold a lot more copies of the Kitty Kelly book, which has got a certain easy notoriety about it. But I hope that in the long run, it isn't going to have much impact at all.
You've interviewed Reagan many times. I'm wondering what he's like to interview and how his memory was when you would talk to him. If he would charm you with anecdotes but not be very forthcoming about information, if he would ever doze off like you said he did in another meeting that he once had.
Well, he was pretty careful not to doze off in interviews.
Right.
Reagan's a difficult interview. He's a difficult interview because he's perfectly charming, but he doesn't tell you very much about himself. You know, when you get into Reagan anecdote, I've likened it. It's likened it to you hit a cassette. If you hit the wrong cassette, you hit the button, and then the record plays at you. So the Reagan interviews were in truth, Terry, they were hard going, but they were usually worth it for me.
Hard going because you couldn't get past the anecdote, the much told anecdote.
Yeah, not just the anecdote. The anecdote. Hard going because you couldn't get by the sort of canned answer. You know, the Reagan rarely let his hair down in interviews, talked from his gut. He usually gave you this kind of scripted answer, and he'd always tell you a story as if you might have heard it 100 times, but like you were the first person in the world that he'd ever told it to you. That could be frustrating. But I've been interviewing Reagan a very, very long time. I started interviewing him for my first book in '68, and I guess I appreciate the fact that after all I'd written about him, he was still willing to sit down with me. And I learned something from from each of these interviews with him.
Well, Lou Cannon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Lou Cannon, reporter for The Washington Post. He covered President Reagan during his California political career and through his years in the White House. Cannon's new book is called President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. This is Fresh Air.